Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, zoonoses, super tasters, diets, and craftsmanship. Hi, Joshna.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Nice to see your face. I am great. How are you?
I'm fine.
We are officially in week four, right?
Is this week four?
For me, my isolation week crossover on Fridays. And so this is now, we're 2 days into week four of our quarantine. I feel like the crazy is starting to really sort of reveal itself a bit, right?
In yourself or in the world?
In myself and in what I'm sensing just on comments on social media, like people are really hitting the wall, as it would be.
Yeah.
It's different. I am the only one around here. So I think it's perhaps a different scenario if this place was teeming with children who are now sweetly desperate to go back to school. Right. Oh, how things have changed for the children. I had a video chat yesterday and I was like, do you want to go back to school? She was like, I want to go back to school so bad.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. How are you over there?
I'm fine. I'm still craving pizza.
Oh, right.
And it's interesting because we did have that conversation in the previous podcast about how safe it is to order food.
Your takeout, right?
But I'm just not comfortable with a third party company handling my food. And I feel like going out to pick up takeout is an unnecessary trip for
me. Adventure out. Yep.
Yeah. I do my groceries once every 2 weeks. And anything above and beyond that seems excessive. And we did our 2 week shop a few days ago, but it was so big, obviously, that putting a frozen pizza in the mix just seemed gratuitous. So give me another 2 weeks.
We'll check in again. I love it. And man, oh man, when you sink your teeth into that bite, it's going to be good.
So did you read this article I sent you?
This mega piece.
From The Guardian?
From The Guardian. I did. And I want to know what your response is to it, because I had my own really mega response to it, but I'd love to know how it landed with you.
You did. For me, I would say the response was overwhelm and just a need to research further and better understand the situation. Okay. But just for some context for our listeners who haven't read the article.
Yes, thank you.
It is about coronavirus and what might be behind it. So coronavirus is, I learned a word. I love learning words. Uh-huh. A zoonose.
A zoonose is amazing, right?
Yeah.
I knew you'd love it when I read that. Yes.
So that's a disease that's passed on from animals to humans. So it could range anything from like salmonella to something like HIV.
Yes.
And obviously coronavirus is one of these.
That's it.
As was SARS. Mm-hmm. And so this article is examining the fact that these have become a lot more prevalent in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it starts off talking about these wet markets in China, which are these markets. My understanding is you can buy both live and dead animals in these markets. They also, I think, do at least the fish, I think they do kill on site. I don't know if they also do butchering. I have never been to a wet market.
They definitely do butchering. And it is, I remember being there in both mainland China and Hong Kong, watching these butchers essentially just have cuts of meat out there, right? Just in my mind, the public health bells were all going off about how things have to be stored and held and all, right?
Yeah.
And just to see that just the vibe and the story and the practice is just a really different one over there. And so when I was thinking about this wet market thing too, thinking, do we have an equivalent here?
Right.
Of a wet market. And to a certain degree, some sections of the St. Lawrence Market in Toronto would be, right?
Similar.
Considered wet markets.
Mm-hmm.
But farmers markets are not completely, although when I did research, they did say that produce sometimes was included there.
Yes.
Right? In wet market stuff. But generally speaking, our farmers markets are pretty dry markets.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And whatever the meat is, it's frozen. vac sealed. Like there's no fresh meat. And if it's whatever else it is, it's like cured sausages and things like that. Right.
How cool that you've been to one.
Yeah. It was, oh my God.
Do you remember what it smelled like? That's sort of the first thing.
Was I smelling men? No, I wasn't smelling men, sadly. I remember that because I was like, man, if there's one place I could smell something, it would be here, right? I went to one in Bangkok and I went to Hong Kong and China.
It seems regardless like an overwhelming experience.
Yes.
From all and wonderful. Aspects.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally. Mega, because you really confront life. Oh, in fact, I was just at one in Mexico City.
Mm.
And we watched these dudes skinning some goats. Oh, boy.
Ooh, like they've done it 50 million times before.
Like no problem. And just the sound.
Oh, dear.
At it, right?
Okay, I think we've done
that. I like to eat that goat. So I got to face this, right? Anyhow.
Conscientious meat eating is good.
I have to be able to look my dinner in the face, as they say, right?
So I think we've painted a very good picture of what these mm-hmm. wet markets are like. And all signs point to the infections transmitting from the animal to the humans in these wet markets.
Yeah.
I don't think we know 100% for sure, but people are quite, scientists and researchers are quite confident that that's where it happened.
They seem to have narrowed it down, in fact, specifically to a bat or this other intermediary. Have you seen the photo of that creature with the shells on the outside?
Yeah.
Woo.
So the interesting thing here is, I think would be very easy to just point a finger at the wet markets and say that's the problem.
Yes.
And this is, you know,
those
don't look right. Yeah. We don't do those here. So clearly, if we just get rid of those, that'll solve the issue. And the really interesting thing about this Guardian article is it takes a step back and it says, you know, these wet markets have been around for a long time. Why is it just now that this is happening? And it says the more important question to ask is not how did it transmit from animal to human, but how did these viruses first develop?
Where did the animal get it? Yes.
And why?
Mm-hmm.
And it theorizes, and it looked like a pretty strong theory from what I could see. They built a solid argument that really factory farming is what is to blame, and big farming.
I've had my suspicions about this, right? Ever since this virus hit, me thinking to myself, this has to be connected to like sort of mostly arrogant human behavior somehow, right? Somehow, how did we do this, right? And I hadn't made that connection just yet. And so I wasn't entirely sure. And so this connected all the dots.
Okay.
Right? And I was like, aha. That's it. These are the links that I didn't have, right? Because everyone was like, it was a bat. Chinese people eat bats and that's the problem, which is not at all the issue, right? It doesn't, the medium does not matter as much. In as only, there's this bird thing, which is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is pretty important. But my question was, how did the bat get this thing, right? The bat didn't generate it. The bat got it from somewhere. And that's really where the conversation needs to start, I think, right? I loved that.
So in this article, of course, they spend some time lingering on poultry farming, inspired by a book called Big Farms Make Big Flu.
Wasn't it so great?
What a dramatic title.
I need to get my hands on that book.
It sounded like your kind of book. And so they explain that, you know, with all these chickens and or whatever fowl it is in close quarters. First of all, they're all on top of each other. So that makes virus transmission easier. And secondly, which I found very interesting, they're bred to be, you know, genetically very similar, to have lots of meat on their bones. I don't, you know, whatever other traits they look for.
Minimal fat. Right, all the leanness.
Probably exactly they're looking for well-tempered ones, I'm guessing.
Yeah, you know,
yeah. And the way viruses spread or don't spread have to do with genetic mutations, right? So that's sort of what keeps viruses in check. And a lot of scientists have proven that if you have a bunch of hosts that are all genetically very similar, that allows the virus to just thrive and to continue to mutate and continue to mutate and become something really powerful and scary.
Right.
And then add to that the fact that these factory farms are pushing small farmers out into remote areas.
Oh, man.
That where
was a big one, right?
Yeah. The land is less fertile, so the larger companies are not interested in.
Yes.
Yep. And those farms are often near forests, and that's where the bats are. So we were starting to put, you know, connect the dots, so to speak.
It makes a lot of sense, right? They're the two pieces that I loved so much was this the clear link between the emergence of highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses and intensified poultry production systems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? That is super important because the timing, even they quoted some timing, which said that the reduction, they talked about the horses, right? And that when horses were the mode of transport before cars, humans were more susceptible to diseases that horses carried.
Yeah.
Right. And then the advent of the motor car meant the reduction in the horse, which simultaneously coincided with the rise in poultry farming.
Yeah.
Right. So that we just, on average, we don't realize it, but so much of what we consume is around a lot of densely packed birds.
Yeah. And I love the, right? I don't know if you caught this quote, but I loved the sentence, chicken isn't cheap if it costs a million lives.
Yes.
Because a lot of what they're doing is cost cutting measures. And
yes, for efficiencies. Right?
Yeah.
And for efficiencies. And
I guess when the birds have these viruses, if it doesn't affect their meat production or their egg production or whatnot, then they, you know, they don't really feel they need to do something about it.
Yep.
And meanwhile, the virus is getting more and more virulent in the population until it's, you know, able to, I don't understand what it is, but there's a, you know, a virus has to have certain specific traits to be able to be passed on to humans.
Right, ready to move over, right.
So it develops that mutation or whatever that extra piece is, and then, you know, off to the wet market we go.
I had been thinking about this, and I found another piece. Actually, I think it might have also been The Guardian. Thank you, The Guardian, if you're listening. A reduction in biodiversity is what creates the conditions for viruses like this to grow, right? And obviously, the food justice advocate inside of me is like, yes, let's talk about that. You know what I mean? Connecting it to biodiversity is where we have a connection to human behavior, right? Because it's our hands that are eliminating, you know, slowly eliminating biodiversity. And that is the piece because there's a quote here that says that if a virus gets introduced into such a flock that has birds that are almost near genetic clones of one another, right, is the idea. If a virus gets introduced into such a flock, it can race through it without meeting any resistance in the form of genetic variants that prevent it from spreading. Right. So genetic biodiversity are walls that will prevent this virus from continuing. It's walls that the virus will literally hit up against.
Right. And it's the polar opposite of what you mentioned off the top of this conversation, which is people pointing to China and saying, you guys eat all kinds of weird things and bats. And it's the opposite end. The people who are minimizing the variety and focusing on making many of the same thing, that appears to be where the issue is arising.
That's it. Right? So, chasing boneless, skinless chicken breast.
So while you were connecting the dots and feeling a sense, can I say a sense of vindication? Would that be fair?
100%, yes.
I went into overwhelm and concern because I really don't see what the solution is. And the other piece of this article, it was just a short piece, so it was easy to miss, but they did mention that everyone's pointing their fingers to Chinese policy and how that needs to be, addressed. But a number of these poultry farms are not even owned by the Chinese.
Yes.
So they mentioned that one, just as one example, a U.S. company called Goldman Sachs bought
finance.
10 poultry farms for $300 million. So that tells you these farms are not small.
No.
And at that point, I don't know how it works. Who's actually making the decisions? And if it's someone who's making the decision from far away, it's a lot even easier to, you know, ignore a virus that's going through a chicken population that, you know, isn't affecting the meat. and doesn't and can't be transmitted through eating them.
Right, and the humans who are affected are far away.
Yeah.
Right? They're far away. It, like, I have to say, as somebody who has been running through the streets with a megaphone about paying attention to our food system,
yeah,
there is vindication, albeit very dire, intense circumstances, but there is vindication in the fact that that this is a tool for me now to say this is just, the stakes have just gotten higher on our distorted and dysfunctional relationship with our food.
So Josh, I have to tell you a story.
Okay, let's hear it.
And it's a story about cilantro.
Yeah, yeah, talk to me.
And this story starts when I was 18. I moved to Montreal to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I went for fall.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're aware of this, but in Toronto they make fall with basil on top.
Yes.
And in Montreal the trend is to put cilantro.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Okay.
You know how there's those moments, culinary moments that are just impressed in your memory?
Mm-hmm.
This is one mm-hmm. of the big ones for me.
Okay.
Was sitting down in front of the soup, tasting this pho, and having this amazing, delicious flavor in my mouth that I had never experienced
okay.
in my life.
Okay.
And I remember coming back so excited at the winter holiday. And talking to my mom and saying, I have discovered this amazing, rare herb. And it's called cilantro.
And I love my mom's proclamation. That's amazing.
Well, I assumed it was this, you know, really rare thing, especially because I'd had pho in Toronto many times
right,
before.
Right, of course.
I hadn't
okay.
come across it. My mom just looked at me and she said, no, cilantro is very common. Yeah. The only reason that you have not had it is because it tastes disgusting to me.
Right. Okay. Your mom's got it. Okay.
So I was initially horrified because how could anyone not find this flavor?
Right.
Spectacularly delicious.
Mm-hmm.
But then I learned what we now know, which is it's genetic.
Yes.
Some people actually have a gene. It's called OR6A2.
Yes.
About 4 to 21% of the population have this gene, and it makes cilantro taste like soap.
Yeah, and even smell like it. Right? It said like this, the everything, just their whole, the, whoever's got this thing has this recognition of soapiness with cilantro, which is, I don't have it.
It sounds really not fun.
But it is really, and it's like, it is such a black and white thing that I feel like, quote, like cilantro is the benchmark that things are, you know, you either hate him or you love him. He's like cilantro. I don't know of any other food that's this polarizing. I mean,
there are foods we like and don't like, and there's gray zones, but this is actually a genetic.
That and nothing, I have never encountered anything else that has been backed up by the science like this, right? That mm-hmm. is beyond personal preference. Right?
Yeah.
It is definitely. And so when I read this piece, obviously because I'm deep in it with my own smelling, mm-hmm. the conclusion they were making, though, is that these folks who do experience the soapiness might be smelling more like the you know what I mean? They have what they're calling hyperosmia compared to my
yes.
anosmia, right? They're like super duper smellers who are catching more than they need to, which is where perhaps people are suggesting this soapy experience is coming from, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's why this particular article drew me in, because I think that genetic connection was made a while back.
Right.
But I never realized that it could be an indicator that someone is a super taster.
That's it.
And they have these heightened ability. I never associated cilantro tasting like soap being a positive.
That,
like
exactly. Or a sign of something, right.
A sign of, yeah. Of
superior.
Having a greater
kind of, yeah.
skill. Yeah.
So that in the piece you sent, they mentioned a study, right, where they mm-hmm. sort of mentioned the prevalence of cilantro dislike
yes.
across the world. And I was like, I want to know more. So I went and dug around and read through the first few bits of that study.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most hilarious things was revealed. And that was that they did... they have subjects from various parts of the world, and they're measuring the prevalence of dislike. Okay.
Of cilantro.
The prevalence of dislike of cilantro. 17% Caucasians, 14 Africans, 21% East Asians. Curiously, Europe does not appear to be here. So I'm not sure where Europe falls. However, the really key numbers are South Asians, 7% dislike.
Much lower.
Hispanics, 4%. And Middle Eastern folks, 3%.
That is interesting.
And so automatically in my mind, I was like, there has got to be a connection between the cultures who use a ton of this stuff in their cuisine and this dislike. Right? It's not this, the study is proving that, right? Mm-hmm. Indian, South Asian food, so Hispanic, so Latino food, right? And Middle Eastern food are full of cilantro.
Because more of them appreciate the flavor.
Well, there's this beautiful chicken and egg conversation. Is it what the ground offered up? Is it that these are the people that like this food? Do these people like this food because that's where it grew? Like
that the super tasters just didn't make it.
Right? And then when we think about this super taster piece, if the larger percentage of people with dislikes towards cilantro are people who are from cultural regions or geographic regions that don't really use the food, but those are in fact, if those people are now considered super tasters, it really says something about what our tasting benchmarks are.
Let's talk about keeping a varied diet.
Yes.
Because I came across this article and it clarified something for me that I thought was very interesting. Because I, of course, try to have as varied a diet as possible, but my breakfasts are always the same. I always have the exact same thing for breakfast. Okay. And what I thought was really interesting in this article is they specifically talked about breakfast and they said, you don't really need to worry. If you have oats for breakfast every morning or toast, it doesn't really matter what you, because we're just talking about different kinds of cereal grains.
And starch, yes.
And where it's really important to vary your diet is to vary your natural foods. So your seeds and your vegetables and your fruit. And the idea that, as we all know, these each contribute different nutrients and you want to make sure, I think you mentioned in a previous episode, to have a rainbow on your plate.
That's how we teach kids. Yes.
I think it was when we were talking about the food guide.
Yeah. That's exactly it. I love this piece because it was a like confirmation of something that I'd been sort of rolling around with. It reminded me of a moment a few years ago when I was planting seeds in my apartment to grow into little sprouties that would then go out onto the balcony and grow all sorts of kale and tomatoes and all these nice things.
Yum.
A farmer pal was visiting and she was watching me sort of lovingly planting all of these seeds. And just super casually in her conversation, she says to me, "Oh yeah, vegetables are how we get nutrients from the earth."
Huh. Right?
And I looked at her and I was like, "What are you talking about, woman?" And it has stuck with me ever since because I had never understood this way, right? I had never understood that there were nutrients in the core of the earth that we live on and that vegetables and the food that we grow on the land is the delivery mechanism for this. And that each thing, each vegetable, each fruit looks different because it carries different nutrition. And so the reason we need to eat a varied diet is so that we maximize the nutrition that we are getting in from the earth to essentially keep us alive, right?
That's a really cool way to think about it. You know, I've always thought, oh, there's different vitamins and different minerals and different foods and sort of left it at that. But I really like this idea of the nutrition coming from the earth. It's a very sort of primal. Wonderful.
That's exactly it, right? And it really makes you think about people, about why we'd advocate for eating food that's not covered in pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It makes a bit more sense when you understand what the original purpose is, right? I find it super helpful to reposition your perspective.
It was particularly nice to tuck into this article and to know that these two nutritionists also feel the same way. It was
totally. And in fact, I was delighted because I realized when I read the piece that one of the two folks who had authored it is Mark Bittman.
Wait, who's that?
Right. Mark Bittman is a big deal of a dude. He's a food writer, New York based, perhaps most famous for a series of cookbooks called How to Cook Everything.
I've never heard of those.
He is tremendous. He really is an ally of all things good food. And he really is pushing to work to help people understand more how to eat.
Nice.
Right? And so, in fact, last year sometime, he and somebody else, I can't remember who, wrote this like definitive tome of an article called How to Eat. And it was like a beautiful, almost like a like an interview style with answering questions about keto diets and paleo diets and dairy-free and gluten-free and vegan and what's healthier and what's not healthier and how we understand values, right, amongst all of this. And it's...
Well, that's an article I'd like to read.
You should. And in fact, perhaps our listeners would as well. So maybe we'll put that up on the website on this episode's page and so that we can share it with others, because I trust him as a source. And I think you'd really appreciate having sort of a definitive word on these issues.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't wait to read that. We'll put it in the show notes.
Awesome. Okay, my dear, you sent over this piece about how much you need to know about brewing beer, right? And it was this awesome bit that really went deep into historical ale production and brewers in on the other side of the Atlantic, right? Essentially to where we are. It's like the UK and other parts of Europe. Belgium, right, was mentioned, and the Netherlands. But there... It solicited so many responses for me, right? This is a very prolific conversation. And so I'd love to know, I want to know what you think about this beer thing, and then I'll tell you about how I feel the connection to the kitchen is involved. But tell me what you think, because I don't know enough about beer.
I'm glad that there's a kitchen connection there. I suspected that you would have some thoughts and opinions. But yeah, so this all started, it's quite a conversation that's going on online. And it started with a blog post that was written called Five Breweries Every Serious Beer Fan Should Visit.
Yes.
And this particular list was all European breweries, and it was all old school European breweries that have been doing very specific things like floor malting or open fermentation, these techniques that have since been replaced by more modern techniques, but these breweries have stayed and they've been doing the same thing for years and years and years. And in the introduction, this article basically said, you know, to really appreciate beer, you have to go back to its roots. And right now in North America, things are a little bit insular and we are valuing innovation over craftsmanship.
Right.
And, you know, not surprisingly, it ruffled a few feathers,
right?
This notion. Now, in terms of where I stand.
Yeah. What do you think?
I agree that craftsmanship has been lost.
Okay.
For sure. And I don't know if we could point only to the fact that people don't have experience with a large number of breweries in terms of travel. Certainly for myself, from my early days in beer, I saw travel as a necessity. It even in days where I could barely afford it, for me, if I wanted to understand German beers, I had to go to Germany. If I wanted to understand Belgian beers, I had to go to Belgium. That's just temperamentally where I was at. And it is possible that those experiences are what have colored my view. But there are other factors. And I think it's fair to say that right now, it's really innovation led.
Okay.
I mean, just look at the beers that are out there. It's like, oh, can we put breakfast cereal in beer? Can we make it sour? Can we make it bitter? Can we make it bitter and sour at the same time? Can we put hops in it but not make it bitter? And can we make it look like one, you know, there's a blonde coffee beers now. Can we make it look like one?
Course.
They do a little trompe l'oeil. And I think that's greatly driven by consumers. People want new things, new releases all the time. But I do agree that a downside to that is that the craftsmanship is somewhat lost. And that's one thing that I do notice. When I go to Europe, I had this just spectacular experience. It was a few years ago. I hadn't been to Germany in 8 years, I think. And I went to Munich, and they have a beer there called Helles, which is a very light, malt-forward, golden-colored beer. You know, by many North American beer aficionado standards, probably quote-unquote boring, mm-hmm. right? And they serve it in this, I think it's a liter glass. It's an incredibly
wow.
tall, big glass. And I finished that beer, and at the end, I wanted another one. It captivated me. It had these nuances, which I can only attribute to craftsmanship.
Okay.
And I've certainly noticed here a lot of people saying, oh, this beer is amazing, that beer is amazing, and I taste the beer, and it's really one note. It's like, okay, I understand this is a strawberry beer that has like really intense, real strawberry flavor, but that okay. doesn't make it a good beer. Or I understand that this beer right. is exceptionally tart, but tartness does not a good beer make. You need the balance. You need the depth. And I've been obsessed with this idea of craftsmanship since, I think it's been a few years now. I had this experience in Montreal. I was at a brewery that will remain nameless. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed a glass of, it was a very light fruit beer. It was like a wheat-based fruit beer. It wasn't sour. There was nothing, you know, on the surface remarkable about it. And I had a few sips and my whole body just said, yes.
Oh.
Yes. And I happened to know the brewer. And later on in the day, he walked in and I said, can you explain to me what it is
yeah,
about this
what
beer?
What did you do? Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, this is a wheat beer that I've been honing for 10 years. Oh, and God. That over these 10 years, I've found a way to make it exactly the way I want it to taste. And then when I got it there, I realized that this specific fruit might be a good compliment. So what I was tasting there was the craftsmanship.
Totally.
Right? I was tasting.
Yep.
This took 10 years of thinking and trial and mm-hmm. error.
You were tasting this man's expert tinkering. Yeah.
And that is something that is sadly very difficult to find here, but I don't know if I could point to travel being the solution. I don't know exactly where the solution is, because I think yeah. it would be challenging for a brewery to always make the same beer for an extended period in time in North America. That's just
yeah,
not what
because essentially
want.
Beer is a living thing,
mm-hmm.
right? That should be, the variation should be embraced. But you know, one of the things that hit me when I read this was I wondered if there was a like old school, new school vibe about any of this. Like there is with wine, right?
Yeah.
And is there a sort of roguishness perhaps with attitudes of brewers on this side of the Atlantic? Right? Because that's really where the conversation is being had.
That's
on
where
opposite
the question
sides,
that's what the
on
question
opposite
is.
Sides,
yeah.
right? Of the Atlantic is there this back and forth that they have with the like the you know you they look east, you know, those of us over here look eastward yeah. and say you are too steeped in tradition, you are too inflexible,
right.
uninnovative, whatever, whereas they perhaps look over the ocean to us and be like, you are untethered, you know what I mean, you're not anchored in anything, you're making yeah. superficial, senseless things that aren't proof of any real skill.
Right.
Right. And that seemed to me to be a bit of the tone of this conversation, right?
Yeah. And that's a fair comment. You know, well, are they not doing it because they're not aware of what it is, or are right. they not doing it because they choose not to?
They're choosing not to. Mm-hmm. So it's super fascinating because the same frustration exists in the kitchen.
Ooh, tell me.
Right. For sure. When I think about this, the same craftsmanship that you're talking in the kitchen, in a culinary context, I would say that's about education and culinary school. Mm-hmm. And right, and obviously Escoffier and the French and all of it, right? Because anybody can agree about the fact that culinary school is not required to be a good chef.
Right.
Right? There are plenty
the same
of
thing
amazing
in beer.
Chefs, mm-hmm. right? Who have not set foot into a culinary academy and who are killing it.
Yeah.
So it is not required. I did it. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you that it definitely provided skill and structure to the way I cook. It taught me a lot about just cuts and timing, you know what I mean? The sort of really practical
time-proven methods.
Precisely, right?
Why it reinvent works. The wheel, yeah.
It works. But there is a tension. There's a push and pull. Because I feel like I can make both arguments really well. I can say it's not required in this because food is such a fundamentally human thing, mm-hmm. I believe. You can have a chef who's doing a wonderful, marvelous job, doing beautiful cuts, you know what I mean? Whatever. Mm-hmm. They didn't get taught how to brunoise with the same diligence that I did, you know what I mean? Getting graded, you know what I mean? Whatever it is. Bottom line, can you make that tiny dice? That's all that counts, right? Mm-hmm. Now, on the other side of things, though, I have had great conversations with other chefs in town, particularly chefs whose personal cultural background is not European, right? Which meaning that we were sort of put through the European paces in culinary school, and now we've become professional chefs. We've been doing it for a while. Mm-hmm. But there's this really clear idea that it's because we have that foundational knowledge that is now opening up opportunities for innovation right now.
Yeah.
Right? It is the remixes and the beautiful, new, interesting, nuanced things are as a result of some level of mastery.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. We have mastered the basics to a certain degree. And in fact, I just watched a documentary about Miles Davis. And he did the very same thing. He went to Juilliard during the day, mm-hmm. and then he played clubs in New York, in the city at night, right? Because he was frustrated, but he had that mastery of skill, but then he you know what I mean? He figured out his own way to do it. But you can argue well that had he not had that formal education, he would have not been quite as innovative.
Yeah, I think this conversation is well-suited to music for sure,
yeah.
and to many different areas. And for me, the interesting thing was really the fact that there is a prevalence in North America towards innovation. There's very, very few breweries doing the other approach. And
right.
in food, are you finding there's a sway as well? Or is it really a balance of both coexisting?
No, there is. I think it's a balance of both because we see a lot of French restaurants opening mm-hmm. up. And I've been surprised at how many French restaurants who want to stay as true to, you know, in Canada here, right? To stay as true to a classic bistro or, you know what I mean? Whatever the context of a French restaurant might be without, and there's pride in the sense that there's nothing fussy and fusion and there's no, you know, yuzu
right.
or lemongrass, you know what I mean? Like this is classic French flavor and there's pride and comfort in that.
And do you feel that there might be a noticeable difference from someone going into, you know, crazy fusion exotic dishes who has the background and someone who doesn't? Or would you think it would?
I will say yes.
Okay.
Because I 100%. And I still think that the most effective experiments are done when you're standing on skill and knowledge, right? And we see that when we're like, okay, how can we do this, but we can give this a different flavor or do that. Mm-hmm. Well, you need to understand how that cake works. You need
yes.
to understand what happens with the eggs and the sugar and the, you know, mm-hmm. in there. You need to understand what it is about that marinade that's breaking down the proteins of that meat and will allow you to sear it in a certain way. And you can't just fling things on there to be different.
Right.
I mean, you can. But I think it's a bit disrespectful and it's too much of a risk to take every time you cook something.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad there's that crossover there. I was wondering if I was going too niche with this conversation.
No, it was a good one. There's lots of ways this could have gone. I loved it. Thank you.
If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave a rating or review. It helps others find us. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Original music by Dave Bell. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.